ours who got this question, and it's a very, very common question. But the gist of this is what does it mean? What role do you play as a Jewish chaplain in a multi-Jewish denominational and also in a multi-faith setting? And of course, I think this case brings up a number of the issues that we've talked about before. So it gives us a chance to kind of, you know, process this as a group. Okay, so who wants to read this vignette? Somebody who hasn't spoken before or would like to hear your new voice? Yes, thank you.
Okay, is the situation of death and burial that's not compatible with traditional Jewish law?
No, I just want to point out, I mean, I am mindful that the situation for some people would be okay, but we're using this as a template to talk about something that butts up against a place. So this is a template case, okay? Please go ahead.
Cindy Parker, age 43, has become progressively more involved with Jewish life over the last few years. Her widowed mother is now in a coma, dying in the hospital. She asked to speak with the chaplain.
That's you. So it could be, you know, you could be Reedin, chaplain, rabbi, whoever it is. Okay.
Cindy states, "My mom told me several times that she wants to be cremated after her death. I know this is not Jewish tradition, but I feel that I must respect her wish. I hope you can guide me. Is there a proper way to spread ashes? Is there a certain amount of time I'm supposed to wait before doing so? I've decided to hold a service in our backyard, one of my mom's favorite places. There's another issue. A few months ago, my mom went to the funeral of a family friend and was so moved by how the minister conducted the service. As the reality of her own death drew near, my mom told me that she would like the minister to lead her funeral. I was very uncomfortable with this and prevailed on her to change her mind. Mom agreed to have a rabbi lead her service, but was adamant about cremation. I really don't begin to know how to find a rabbi to do this. I think my mom is going to die in the next day or two, and I know that Jewish custom is to have the funeral right away, so I want to be prepared."
Okay, so this is by no means an esoteric or unusual situation, right? So going through our rubric, you know, the template, so you've listened actively, and you're establishing and maintaining, I mean, clearly you have an alliance with this congregant because she's talking openly. What is your emotional pulse reading? So just anybody, just say anything. Yes?
I'm upset.
Okay, you're upset because of why?
Because it's always, I mean, this is a difficult situation. You as a rabbi, you uh-huh. know that it's really, you know, from, say, my value system, the wrong thing to do for her.
Okay.
And yet, you're not necessarily, it depends on what your role is with this person, you're not necessarily in a position to say that,
mm-hmm.
at least not say that very explicitly.
Okay, so the cremation is really hitting you hard, but you're really not in a position, you feel like you know, what can you really say in this position about it? Yes, what emotional pulse, we're on a
My moment. Emotional pulse is home, because
okay.
I've been a hospice chaplain for many years, and I've come across this situation multiple times.
Okay.
And I'm actually, yes, if I had my druthers, you know, mom would be buried instead of cremated, but mom felt really strongly, this is a pastoral issue, it's not a halachic issue at this point. My job is actually to help her figure out how to carry out her mom's wishes and how to do, as Rabbi Elliot Dorf says, the most Jewish thing.
Okay, right. So, okay, yes, other, is that a, yes?
Yeah.
Other
I think
emotional pulse.
I'm kind of in line with Suzanne, but also curious, because in order to fulfill, I guess, or do the most Jewish thing, as Elliot Dorf would say, is to, I'm really curious about the mom's connection to Jewish tradition.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In terms of like honoring mom in the most Jewish way, even if she's made this explicitly clear that she's going to cremate it.
Okay. Other emotional pulse. Any other, right, that was actually from the story. I mean, we could have, that makes it a little more complicated. But the setup is sort of like, at least this girl already pulled back from the mother's request. She already bargained with the mother about not having the minister. So how much with this dying mother can you prevail on her? And, like, you know, she's set up pretty clearly, like there's no negotiation about the cremation. Okay, so any other emotional pulse reads that we want to get on this situation? Okay, how about number two? Is there any danger? Is there any danger? Anybody feel danger? What about spiritual danger? You're allowed to register if people feel, if you feel like, that's something you need to know. Yes, okay, we have two hands.
There's a legal, just a legal issue with scattering.
Yes.
Scattering is illegal almost everywhere these days.
Yes, okay.
The rest.
Okay. Okay.
Different question, but there's a legal issue.
Okay, so that's you know, I never thought of that. You're absolutely right. Okay, so the legal issue of scattering cremains or ashes, whatever you want to call it. Okay. Yes, and Paul.
I would just try to find out if there, you know, if there are any dangers in terms of reactions by other members of the family.
Okay.
Because there are going to be people on both sides of this, and you just want to make sure that the person you're dealing with is prepared for and has thought about.
Okay.
Potential
reverberations. Okay. But let's say we have this situation. It could be this. It could be a situation of end of life. It could be abortion, whatever. And for some people, it might be like, I'm clear about my pastoral role. And for some people, they may be clear about their pastoral role. But like you were saying, it can really be very, very upsetting. Now, if something is too upsetting, and you know that, what might you do? Like you feel like your objectivity or your ability to be really pastoral is compromised. Yes.
You pass the case on to
yes.
Else.
Yes. Yes, you do. And I don't think that's anything. I think we need to know what we can do and what we really can't do with a full enough heart, because it is just too hard and you don't have to do everything. And I think it's sort of like you know, that beautiful, where is that from, morning davening, about all the different things you do that get you olam haba, you know, dressing the bride and visiting the sick and doing this and doing that. Not all of us can do all of it. And you got to find what you can do. And if you can't do something, know it. And if something, thank you for saying that, because if something is too hard, just know it. And if you can find your way to doing, you know, what you think is the role in the job, all right. But if you can't, then you need to know that. I think that's a really important thing. Okay, what about, does the situation require emergency intervention? Not exactly, but it is time sensitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty time sensitive. Like, she really needs to know, like, what's going to be. The mother is dying, and she needs to have some kind of clarity and closure in place. So I think that when we talk about, like urgency, there's also time sensitivity. A place where this really comes in a lot, obviously, is end of life, but it also has a lot to do with, abortion and intervention type of issues, in pregnancy and gestation, all kinds of things. Okay, so in terms of what does this congregant, this is Cindy, what does she want here? And what's your role? Okay, so she asks, She asks all these questions. I mean, she says, I know it's not Jewish tradition, but how should I do it? Now, one point that was brought up was, and I want to just add to this, is that are there other relatives? What's going to be the family response to this, to this funeral, to this cremation? What other things might you bring up that would be of relevance to Cindy making this decision? Yeah.
Can I just say, it doesn't seem like she's making a decision. It seems like she wants help. It feels like we're discussing the
okay, the decision's made. How to guide her through it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So it doesn't seem like she's, do I cremate or not cremate? That seems done.
Okay, right. So I take that back. You're right. It's going to be done. So we're now talking about how might you guide her to go through with it in a way, because she says, I just erased it. How to do it the most Jewish way possible. Well, what's the most Jewish way possible? Like, what would you advise somebody in a situation like this, assuming you're staying in it?
How do you define the most Jewish way possible?
Right, but how do you define
it?
That's right. Yes, any thoughts? Like, let's say she says, my mother loves the pier, you know, we're in the Pacific, and I was going to, dump the ashes or cremains, whatever, off of the pier in her favorite spot. Or I'm taking a tugboat out, or whatever. Yeah, okay, thoughts?
I don't feel like there's a Jewish answer to that.
Okay.
I feel like the Jewish answer is, well, what do you do with the funeral, with memorial?
Okay.
That's where we have...
Okay.
There's no cremation in Jewish...
Okay.
I mean...
Okay.
So we take the values from a traditional Jewish funeral and burial.
Okay,
okay. And see how much of it is relevant.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's not relevant, then you say... then you're having another conversation that has nothing to do with Judaism.
Okay, so you're going to take what is Jewish from the traditional funeral, burial, mourning rituals and try to bring that in. Yes?
In the end of it, after the fact, you bury the cremains.
Okay, why? Important point.
There's halakha on this.
Okay.
If someone asks you beforehand,
right.
You say, if someone asks you beforehand, the traditional answer is no, you can't do that, no, you shouldn't do that.
Okay.
If someone asks you afterwards, then you instruct them on how to bury it.
Okay, and what might you say from a pastoral point of view about burying the cremains? As opposed to dumping them off the pier, pouring them, yes.
I hit that battle with my parents.
Okay.
My parents paid for their cremation.
Right.
And we did everything else. And the two issues that were important to me and what I share with people who choose to put them on a shelf is, you know, somebody's going to throw them away eventually because they're not going to know who the heck this is. Is that what you really want done with it?
Right.
Down the road. But for us, it was important that we had a place.
Exactly. Exactly.
And therefore, the burial of the cremains
yes.
became important. So my folks are buried.
Yes.
They got their wishes, and then we got everything else was
having
was
a
done
place.
With the tradition,
it's very
and
terrible.
We were able to then teach her about mourning customs and how she can follow up with them, and we were able to do our
okay.
mourning customs
okay.
following the burial.
Okay, two more thoughts. Yes.
I would just say, like, when I've been involved in stuff like this, it's more right about having a service sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. Even if it doesn't involve the cremains, I feel like you can just do stuff, mm-hmm. have Shiva.
Right.
But because place mm-hmm. sometimes means something, but sometimes people would say, well, I want to just go to the ocean. I mean,
okay.
or the lake. So I think that, like, the immediacy of doing something and gathering people mm-hmm.
Okay.
is where I sort of have worked
okay.
with people on here.
Yes.
So I don't mean to fight with the hypothetical, but one of the things that's bothering me a little bit is we don't know the reason why the mother is so adamant.
Right,
about
no, we don't. Right.
And I think that knowing that might answer some of these other questions. So, for instance, a lot of people today, Jews and non-Jews, want cremation because they don't want to saddle their children with expense
uh-huh,
of burial.
Uh-huh.
And if they had a conversation about that, might that actually change the answer? It would be more distressing for me to have you cremated than to pay the funeral expenses. Or, I don't want to be buried. I'm afraid of being buried. Well, that might change our decision about what
right.
we do with the ashes. So, something is I'm struggling, and it is time sensitive, but it looks like there might still be time to have that conversation with mom. Understand that better.
And if not with mom, maybe with the daughter. But I think I want to generalize your point to a larger thing that it's you're never going to go wrong trying to have a conversation about something that feels, you know, problematic or burdened or it's, you know, it sticks in some way. You know, certainly there was something that was on my mind about. Okay, so here is a question about the choice of. Well, I think we were talking about it earlier with the end-of-life decision-making. But there's no way that airing out and inviting more information into a situation isn't going to be clarifying in some way. I mean, it may not change the outcome, but I do think that that's an always, you know, a good thing to do. And even to say, like, you know, I know we can't ask your mother, but what do you think? You know, what do you imagine this means to her? And I think that asking, right, maybe she woke up, you know, we can have her wake up too, gives you the opportunity to possibly dispel very painful, even like sometimes like childlike fears. Like that notion of being buried alive is something that people carry with them. And saying that out loud in the light of day to a competent person who's in the medical environment can be very relieving with death being quite inevitable and being in the picture. Even if it doesn't change the outcome of the cremation, you know, decision, it is, I think, you know, extremely relieving. So I definitely want to go with that. Shall we run through some of these questions, which are kind of generated by responses that I got? Questions to consider. Who wants to read those?
Where does Judaism play a role in facing the larger world?
Okay, now this kind of comes to something. Actually, we were talking about this at the end of the last vignette. I think Karen made this point that the educational piece of this, like, is can be very important. You know, whether it's to Cindy herself, to the rest of the family, to the, I mean, if let's say this discussion is going on in the hospital, I think that having, this is an opportunity to educate and to promote an understanding of Jewish values, however you want to see it, to the larger world, whatever, whoever that world is. Okay, so we'll keep on going.
What happens when events that may go against our beliefs?
Okay, I think we talked about that. I don't know if people have more, like, I think that, you know, that this, of course, happens, and your role as a rabbi, as a chaplain, are you doing your chaplaincy role? You know, how does that, if that butts up against your rabbinic positions, you know, how do you deal with that? How about the last one there? Okay, so what have been experiences that you've had that have challenged you in this region? I mean, I can think of some that students have told me, that rabbis have told me, but I'm wondering from you, have you been asked to pray in a vernacular that really feels very un-Jewish to you, for example? So how do you work that?
What, you mean the people that aren't Jewish, you mean?
What?
Or that are Jewish or that are not Jewish,
but you're the chaplain who's been called to the bedside and you've been asked to say, you know, to speak to Jesus on behalf or whatever.
I mean, I don't speak to Jesus. So
okay.
I do a prayer that I do, and they always add Jesus if they want to their baptism.
But does Jesus speak to you?
But they all kind of like, it's just the way, like, when you do something else, they don't do it. I just sort of leave this quiet pause, and they usually fill it in just fine.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I wanted to get back.
Please. Go ahead.
Okay. I appreciate what you said, which is to find out, to explore with this person why the mom wanted this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think what's going on here is this daughter is struggling. Maybe she's not struggling, but I'm struggling with her conflict between I want to honor my mother and what really goes against now that I'm more observant, more practicing in this school. And when is it okay to say, you know, I really go against my parents' wishes because I think this is wrong.
Mm.
And when you do that, sometimes you have to do that.
Right.
And I think that's something that maybe chaplain, you could explore that with them. I mean, I once officiated a funeral of someone who didn't want to be buried, but it wasn't a cremation. They put him in a mausoleum. We did a whole funeral. They did a mausoleum in Shul, and I remember it was like above ground because they didn't want to be buried. But okay, there's mausoleums in Jewish history. It was fine.
Mm-hmm.
But so we got around it that way. You know, I mean, it would be interesting to find out what was going on there if she could tap into that, and then could she then find a way to reconcile?
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's not asking this person as a chaplain to officiate. It doesn't sound like
Well, that is a sub-question that comes up here. You know, how do you find somebody to do what you don't want to do?
Sure.
But that's another, yeah.
I've done that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't appreciate the intermarriage, so I have to.
Okay, right. Classic example.
I found someone who I thought would be really good counseling for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to be related to someone.
Right.
So I'm working where I was working, where I work, and also.
Well, that kind of, you know, attributes to the power of the, you know, how important it is to have a Rolodex established for these kind of situations. Yes?
I think any time a chaplain's, this kind of conversation oftentimes does lead to, well, would you officiate at the service?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
I mean, even if the people don't start with that as their opening question, right, they're kind of sizing up the chaplain, because it's obviously a new relationship oftentimes, but it often ends up there, so I think the chaplain has to be aware of whether this is something they feel comfortable doing.
Okay, so I think that would be a great role play. How about we do that right now? Who wants to be the chaplain, and who wants to ask the chaplain to officiate? Let's say that the chaplain doesn't want to officiate a cremation, and is a really great chaplain, and the patient's family, you know, the family member has been very moved by their help, and now wants to ask this chaplain to officiate, and the chaplain's going to have to make it probably a negative. Who wants to do that? You want to do it? Be the chaplain?
Sure.
Okay, who wants to be the patient? Who wants to be the congregant? Cindy? You're Cindy. Okay. Okay, so just move back. Right. I know you're Sarah, but I like to use a name. Right, because you're not Sarah, now you're Cindy. Yeah, okay.
You're Cindy.
Yeah. You can be you, though. You can be another rabbi if you want. Okay, go ahead. Just take it away.
So I know I need to get my plans in order. You seem Jewish enough. Will you officiate?
disservice, but I can find, I have colleagues who I know would be very good at it, and I can put you in touch with them, and I'm sure we can find someone who's going to do a good job.
Push on it. You want him.
So, with your colleagues, what is it that you're, how do your colleagues come to the conclusions that they come to?
Well, they're generally, I mean, they're coming from different backgrounds in the Jewish world, and they have a different perspective on what they feel comfortable doing, and, you know, they have their teachers and their understanding, and, I have to stay true to sort of what I feel, you know, who I am, and I certainly want to meet your needs to the greatest extent I can, but I also need to stay true to what I believe.
So the truth is, I'm kind of, I'm in between a lot of things, and I know we haven't met a lot, like, I feel comfort in knowing you and your face, mm-hmm. and you've met my mom, you know her, you've seen her. And so I'm hearing that we might need to do some negotiations, but like, is there a middle way? Is there a third way for us to meet?
Thank you very much, first off. It's so important to you that I'm involved. It's a very important ceremony, and I appreciate that a lot. I'm really sorry that I'm not able to be the officiant. It's just that it's not something that I'm doing. And I apologize. I mean, I understand where you're coming from. Someone I know will do a really good job and will get to know you and talk through with you about your mother's life and will really have a great job of shooting the service.
So you'd be able to tell them about mom.
Yeah.
Okay. Cindy, what worked for you here? Because clearly something worked. I mean, you also weren't looking for a fight, but you know, you really were responding to something. But what worked? Because
a colleague that I know.
Okay.
And they acknowledged the, I'm not remembering the exact language.
Doesn't matter.
This is the thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
For
how about that pause? Didn't we all? We're all paying attention to that long pause. It wasn't that long. I didn't time it. But, you know, the why am I talking? You didn't talk. That was a very nice. How did that feel for you when your rabbi was thinking and he was pausing?
As Cindy, I felt I'm being taken seriously.
Yeah. And Sarah?
I was like, oh, I don't want to put you on the spot.
No. I think, and after you paused, that's when you said thank you, and you said I appreciate, and you apologized, which I think felt very sincere. And I think that this kind of, that was very deft of you. You said, is there a third way? I really like, okay, how, you know, whatever. But I think this is kind of thing, okay, this situation is the cremation story, but I think intermarriage is probably a very common place where this comes up, particularly with children of congregants, people who are really just so want you to have an imprint. If you know, they know you, and if you're connected, maybe the kids will convert, and they'll do whatever. But that yearning for you to be involved and the pull, I think, is very, very powerful. You know, and if for some people, if intermarriages are something that you're comfortable with, well, then this is, you know, there's other things. Yes, please. Just say it.
I'm going to say it. Okay.
Yeah.
I grew up in many different worlds. One of the worlds that I grew up was in the black hat world. Okay. What he did would be totally unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
I would have done the same thing, all right?
Mm-hmm.
honestly, right
now.
Can
you say why it would be unacceptable?
I would yell the same thing as you do, 100%.
Okay.
But in my pastoral care, and so I come forth and say that. But in the black hat world, you would be crushed to no end.
If you referred me?
If you referred, that's exactly right. What business, right. It's an ESER, okay, to get another Jew to do cremation, it's worse than yourself doing it because you're getting somebody else involved to do an ESER D'oraisa. And I do 100% what you're doing.
So I would,
guilt.
We're not, the officiating rabbi is not the one doing the cremation.
Yeah,
I'm not saying let me call for you and set up the cremation.
Right.
She's going to do the cremation. Right. The question is, do you feel that it's okay for you to be officiating a service after it happens?
So you talk. What would you have done if she said, "Well, will you at least come?"
Yes, that's like the attendance. Yeah.
I would probably ask her if she's doing a shiva.
Yes.
Or a shiva afterwards, yeah. Or something else.
My mom didn't care about any of that stuff, but it's really important to me that you be there.
I would.
I won't ask you to.
I mean, potentially, I might come if it was really bottom line. I would not officiate.
Would you officiate a shiva minion?
A shiva minion? Why wouldn't you? Yeah, why would you not?
She don't sit shiva after.
Oh, right, right.
Well, not really shiva, right?
But it's a minion.
Right.
I would start right when the question is asked. Usually I'll probably know that it's coming right away when the question is asked. I would start first with an affirmation of our relationship because that's why they're coming to me. Mm-hmm. And whatever is going to come, the practical of it that I'm not going to be able to do, and we'll figure out a way to make sure that to a colleague, start with affirming the relationship that I'm not. You didn't ask me what I should do, so I'm not telling you what you should do. But that's not my, obviously not my place in your world.
It's the referral that is the problem.
Well, but you see, you're parsing it out differently, that you're not, you're not referring to the mortuary, you're referring to somebody who is going to officiate. So I think that's how, whatever.
I mean, the way I see it is, if I officiate, in a sense, you're saying what's going on is okay.
No, right? I'm not saying that.
No, but anyways, if you officiate, meaning if you are the officiant, when I asked Rabbi Schwartz what I could do and what I couldn't do, right? Because ultimately, you're not the one doing the Tara, not doing the Tara, doing the cremation, not doing the cremation. But the rabbi who comes and officiates at the ceremony is, in a sense, if you're officiating, you're saying, I'm putting my heksher on this event, right? So, feeling bound by, the guidance I've been given about what I can and can't do. So there's certain lines I'm not going to cross, but someone else coming from a different perspective may feel differently. And
okay.
The question, you're right. I have no doubt that making a referral would get me hammered in certain contexts, and I'm not that worried about it.
Okay,
let's
hold off on this because there's many other, these are really examples. It would be interesting, like in terms of a preparatory thing, we were talking about the aftermath, but what about preparation? Like, would you do a tahara for somebody that was going to be cremated? Well, how does that strike you?
I'm sorry, tahara?
A tahara, yeah.
For somebody who was going to be...
Yeah, this is before it's happened, right. Which is sort of like, and maybe an analogy, an analog, is that right? Would be like, well, Rabbi, I understand that you can't marry, you can't officiate at our children's wedding, but will you meet with them? Mm-hmm. Those are...
Which is a very different question.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very different question. Mm-hmm.
Two quick comments and a question. Comment number one to Brian. I'm not sure it's an Easter theorizer, at least not based on the 3D age that a number of us studied together in a group meeting a couple years ago. It's an Isser Chomor, but it's not clear that it's Isser D'oraisa. Not burying somebody, maybe it's D'oraisa. Sreifa, not so clear. Comment number two, in the 40 years I've been in the Orthodox rabbinate, and God, I can't believe I'm saying this, I'm such an altar cocker.
Yeah.
But I see.
In
Well, I didn't start here, and it was somewhere in the middle, actually. But there's been a change, a quiet change in Orthodox practice, not on allowing cremation, but on allowing people to mourn after cremation. When I started out, Maurice Lamb's was the, and basically it's usher, it's forbidden, we don't do anything, and that's it, we're done. From the as I proceeded, when I wrote the chapter in my book about cremation, I consulted with a posek about whether to allow a limited minyan in the case of cremation. I was allowed to do that. Through now, where I know of poskim, many of you know these poskim, who have allowed pretty full mourning in cases of cremation, there's been a bit of a change. I can't tell you how this change came about or why it came about. I just know it's out there. My question to Harav Falk.
Oh, no.
Okay. How were you feeling inside when you had this dialogue with Cindy?
Yes, I wanted to come back to because we talked about Cindy, but how about you?
Well, what's of course, harder in one of these things is, well, we're role-playing. I'm aware, unlike a normal situation where you're just with whoever you're with, that it's a room full of colleagues here who are going to analyze what we're doing. So it's hard not to have that narrative going in as well. My feelings were less because I knew this wasn't real, in a sense. In similar conversations, I find these to be wrenching conversations. I want to do whatever I can for them, and yet I also feel bound not to do anything they may ask because I feel constrained by certain parameters, so I find a lot of internal conflict around the specific cremation because this comes up.
Okay, so before we leave this question, how about we just put out there, it's kind of like, it's a way I put it here, what kind of cultural issues come up that get in the way, but what kind of issues have come up that have been the hardest for you, like this? You know, like when you, as you were saying, this is a role play, so it's easier, but what have caused you, what kind of situations have caused you the most heartache in terms of cultural,
Before moving on, just in thinking about my emotional pulse in the city, I didn't feel like I needed an apology. That's just me as a bird. That didn't work.
That didn't work.
That wasn't something that, all of a sudden my head was like, oh, would something bad happen that now you're apologizing for? So just.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I'm glad you put that out there.
I would say in my experience with having these conversations, I usually have not been, I say, look, this is who I am. This is where I'm coming from. I'll do everything I can to help you. I'm not officiating the service. I've never had anyone push it further. People hear that. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to respond to, gosh, this person really, usually people hear that and they get, okay, this is the rabbi, the chaplain or the rabbi is drawing their limits of where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. And they, I mean, that's just, at least, maybe that will be different at some point. Thank you.
So what have been the most challenging types of Jewish cultural, gaps or glitches? I don't know. Yes, Paul.
This is more hypothetical. I don't think I've ever faced it. But I think I would have a very difficult time myself if a gay couple came and asked me to officiate.
Okay.
Now, the fact is, that hasn't happened, and I never did mixed marriages either. But I think that in such cases, I feel even in the anticipation a great deal of anxiety about saying no to something that.
So you're talking about a same-sex marriage, like an officiating capacity.
I wouldn't do that or a mixed marriage. But in both cases, it's the situation of theoretical, ideological issues coming in conflict with my desire to be there for specific people who I have do not want to project onto them the notion that I disapprove of who they are, what they are, or what they want. And so that tension is anxiety producing for me.
Okay, so yes.
So I feel like I have different issues because as someone who is kind of post-halakhic, all these halakhic issues, like I get it, like it's important to you. It's like so like low the shoes to me. And so I have like different
That's what I wanted to put out there. What's the gap?
So one in terms of cultural, I think the hardest one for me right now in where I work,
because
I just have so little experience, is with the Russian community, like
Russian
cultural community and how they interface with American healthcare system, end of life issues is so different.
And can you just give a little rundown because I'm sure there are other ethnic traditions that are
part
of their issues.
The sense that the Russian medical system is very paternalistic, that they aren't given choices. You know, the nurse practitioner to be like, well, these are your choices, and do you want your mom to be DNR? And it's like, are you saying my mother's dying? Like, you can't, this cultural, like, it's a huge, then it becomes a cultural competency cleanup field for the chaplain. And I speak Russian, so it's, I just kind of need that. But the other thing is that in terms of going back to cremation or whatever, like, it's not an issue for me, and I actually, I mean, sort of related, I just did a memorial service for someone who died, who donated their body to science, and their mom was, who was my client, was really upset, because she's like, I can't get out of my head that they're going to chop up his body. Like, that was her pastoral issue, and it was really, there was a real specific reason why he did that. He had a very rare disease. He wanted, he directly donated his body to a research project. So, like, it was, to me, like, a huge mitzvah. Like, he really was paying it forward with this rare disorder he had. But we had to, like, address, that was the issue, you know? So, but I did the whole memorial service like I once did someone's cremation, which is you do everything the same, except
that's interesting.
And you acknowledge that there's no body. You just acknowledge that there's no body. And but you're not hiding anything. You just and use the memorial or funeral service, whatever you want to call it, as a facilitation for the mourners. And that's it. That's all it is. So I just
But I want to put out there, like, whatever your tension, place, struggle has been, it wanted,
I have a bigger problem with a child who will not let the hospice nurse medicate their parent because they don't want to get them addicted to opioids.
Oh,
in the meantime,
yes.
they've got, you know, stage 4 and unstable wounds that need cleaning. And they're in a tremendous amount of pain. Or the son who won't pay for a caregiver because he wants to inherit more money.
Oh yes. Okay. That's
and
I was
so,
waiting.
And so the father in that case is living in a situation which is just horrific.
Which actually these are the kind of, these situations.
Those are the ones that rip me apart.
Yeah, and they might also involve, you know, deployment of senior protective services at times. I mean, that is the, in terms of the legal stuff. I think you were going to say something.
In terms of the Jewish cultural stuff, so I see someone who has schizophrenia and in his 60s, was in his 20s, when he was in his 20s, was accepted into HUC, like, I think, had he not, you know, had a schizophrenic episode, he would have been a rabbi. Like, a lot of stuff around that. We can't, he's not really in a state where we can send friendly visitors, but he needs much more companionship. And he and I study a little bit together. So I found out about the Chabad JNet. And so I was all like, great, then he could study with somebody else because I can't go all the time. And then a reform rabbi who I consult with sort of, is that really what he wants? Like, you know, like sort of warned me whether that was appropriate for this person. And I was like, but I don't really have other Jewish resources. He can't, he's homebound, whatever. He's not going to come to synagogue. So I just felt stuck. So that's been my, like, from the, like we talk a lot about, I guess it's the other direction of the scenario.
I'm not sure I quite followed. Like, what's the issue? whether or not the resource was appropriate, what was wrong with it? I really didn't get what wasn't good about it.
That, like, for a reformed Jew, is like a Chabad teacher on the phone who's from that sort of point of view, would that be appropriate for someone who I know is not from that point of view?
I see.
So
okay.
I had no idea if that, okay. I didn't think it was a problem, but then it made me wonder.
Okay, when the resources might not match the need.
Okay.
You know, that I think is, let's use that as a segue to, I had a request for talking about the interface of mental illness and the chaplain.
Kind of why I brought
fine.
Up,
so let's
like,
do, yeah.
Before we do, I have one important housekeeping announcement. I was waiting for this case to end.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
If you want to go home tonight and you drove here, you need these. This monopoly-looking money are the exit tickets for the garage now.
Oh.
Yeah. And this is mundane, but extremely important. So I'm going to leave them next to Alana in the corner over there where you registered. And just take one before you go. It'll get you out of the garage.
Okay, so we're going to run through two cases of the chaplain in cases of mental illness. So let's do run number three. Who wants to read that vignette?
I will.
Thank you.
Simone Broner, 43, a married woman of two and an international lawyer, has been admitted to the hospital for an acute psychiatric episode. Her husband reports that Simone was working late nights on a major case involving Israel and surrounding countries. Simone, who has a history of bipolar disorder, became more and more preoccupied with the case, stopped doing anything else, stopped taking her meds, and started talking about how resolution of this case would bring the Mashiach. Simone had been in the hospital a week when you visit her. She's now profoundly depressed and says that she has disgraced herself at her farm and ruined her family.
Okay, so this is not an uncommon type of presentation, right? So here's a bipolar woman, and she gets, you know, worked into a state, stops taking her medication, you know, probably is not sleeping, all that kind of stuff, and has an acute break, and then, you know, is probably medicated in the hospital and, you know, goes right down the chute into a terrible depression. So here are some questions, you know, let's just go ahead and read the questions, and let's just throw it open for discussion.
We don't have
questions. Oh, really? On page three. You're on the back. It's just in the back of something. You're not three.
Oh, it's just backwards.
Yeah, it's all, I, as I said, I fed it into my copier back in a weird way. Yeah, page three. Okay, go ahead. Who's reading it? Yeah, what is the role? Whoever has it, just read it. It's only two things. Just read it.
Oh, me.
Go ahead. Whatever. Anybody, yeah.
What is the role of the chaplain in the case? What is the role of the chaplain when the case may be more of a mental health than a spiritual care case? Do chaplains have what do chaplains have to offer in such cases? How would or should spiritual care providers interface with mental health care providers?
Okay, so let's just talk about this case, generally. Those are just two guiding questions. First of all, I must say that rarely do my students get sent, maybe now it's changing in CPE, to psychiatry. I mean, I think, and Bikur Cholim visits, you know, psychiatry has often been like sort of people don't get visited who are, maybe that's changed more and more, but I think most volunteers, you know, who do Bikur Cholim are really uncomfortable with the psychiatric units, and these patients, you know, they're often not allowed, right? You know, these people are kind of languishing. But, you know, what do you think about this interface of this elaborate, maybe, you know, very elaborate, not so elaborate, I mean, I'm sure we've all seen this, of religious motifs that are woven into a psychotic break, and then, you know, what's your role in this? What has your role been? I mean, you all have more experience in this. Thoughts about this story?
This case here, we want to know more about the shame she's reporting in the second paragraph. I don't yet know if it's shame that she involved thoughts of Mashiach about it, or if it was shame that she had a manic episode at work, or
right.
Shame she's in the hot tub. I don't know yet.
But okay.
What's going on with her, because otherwise I'm just projecting all of my own stuff.
Okay, and you know, let's say that this is actually going on in real time, and she said, Rabbi, you know, I can't believe what I did. I'm so ashamed of myself. So you hear that word, and what you're just demonstrated is exactly what I was saying earlier. Develop an initial hypothesis. Stay alert for information. Well, what is the shame about? Is kind of what you're thinking. Well, did she behave in some crazy way at work? Did she start writing memos? Did she, put Mashiach in her? Who knows what she did? But or is it being in the hospital? Like, what is it about? So absolutely, great, right on. Did you? Yes, and then go ahead.
Yes, in general, in these kind of situations we encounter, I think these are the exact circumstances we have to know that we're out of our depth.
That what?
We're out of our depth.
What's your depth? Like, where are you?
Not here, where she's after the fact, she's mm-hmm. in the hospital, but when you have someone who's clearly suffering from mental illness and you recognize, like, my job is to get them
okay.
to
okay.
someone who
right.
has the training to really help them.
Right.
And it has to not be, I'm going to try to solve something with, like, it has to be, how do I get them to help me? It's not, I don't have the type of training that I need to help this person.
Okay.
And the help probably also involves medication.
Yeah, probably. Okay.
Either needs to be prescribed or it's not being taken.
Okay, so let's just put all kinds of thoughts. Yes, Michal.
I was almost sort of touching on the same thing. By the time the chaplain's called here, I mean, it doesn't matter how she got there. She could have been, there's a middling reason to sit there saying, I'm disgraced and I'm ashamed. It's when they call the chaplain because there's someone in the psych unit who thinks they're a Mashiach. That's when, as a chaplain, it's like we're sort of out of the
right.
realm. At this point, she's controlled, she's self-aware, and she can probably have a kind of fairly normal pastoral encounter, at least start one. You know, it's while they're actively, really demonstrating the mental illness symptoms that we sort of end up in that junction.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, I was just generalizing.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think that it's true we're out of our league for sure, and I get confused how much I need to know about schizophrenia, and I worry that, like, with this person that I've been working with, like, I don't want to open things up to being worse, but I feel so clear that we have a role. Like,
okay.
even when they're in a non,
okay.
whatever, delusional moment,
mm-hmm.
I actually feel like since I don't have to solve the mental illness, I can be in that place.
Okay, that's kind of where I wanted to explore. Yeah.
And uh-huh. not, I mean, my patient was in the ICU for physical health reasons,
yeah.
and he told me everyone in the hospital was Nazis and they were torturing him. Like, I'm not the psychiatrist, so I can be. And I also want to say that for chronically mentally ill, I think UW-Hospital, like, they don't get psychiatry on board soon enough. And so one of our roles can be advocates for our patients mm-hmm. to, like, get the physicians who don't, the physical physicians, I don't know what you call them, non-mental health, non-psychiatrists. Like, I just have to say a million times, like, has anyone called psychiatry? Psychiatry needs to be here. It didn't happen for about 8 days.
Yeah.
I just feel like being an advocate for someone who's mentally ill in a hospital is, I think it's huge. But I also think being able to be with them in their delusion.
Yes, that's what I mean. I think that's a really interesting thing. Do you enter into the delusional or whatever it is, colorful language?
If you know they're safe. And I don't mean that.
Okay. Well, I think this is really a fascinating topic. You wanted to say something, Steve, and then we'll come around. Yeah.
Part of it is that. And the other thing is the same issue that I had when I was working in hospice and dealing with people who were totally demented and gone. Spending time with people who are thoroughly lost.
Okay, so this is now dementia we're talking about.
But in this case, also with delusion.
Okay.
Part of what I am showing up to do is to honor them as a human being.
Okay.
And, mm-hmm. and to respect them, so these people are worthy of care, and I am respecting their being by doing it. If they are in the middle of the delusion, I do that. If they're not in the delusion, so I'm at my mental health hospital. I can talk about other spiritual issues with them that are not necessarily a case within that. So I had a young girl who was a cutter and had been suicidal once upon a time. They just wanted to know what the Jewish position about life after death was.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about the hereafter. We can talk about the spirituality of caring for your body and your being and leave the mental issues of why she's cutting and what's going on with that and those other issues for the psychiatrist, but there's a spiritual agenda that I can be a pastorally with her in
mm-hmm.
as a chaplain without dealing with the mental, the other aspects of the mental issues.
Okay, other thoughts? Yes. And, oh, no, I'm sorry. I think you were going to go first, Michelle.
Oh,
and you.
I was just going to say, someone said a bunch of NAJC conferences ago on the topic of mental, there was a session on mental illness, and that it's like you can visit someone's country and then leave them, like, referring to, like, a delusion.
Yeah.
Or, like, a psychiatrist. Like, it's just you visit the country. Like, it's just, it's fine. I think, you know, in my own experience of being on psych floors, like when I was doing internship and residency, was that, you know, just the crucial, just to go to your second question, wherever that is.
It's on page.
Care professionals, I would say, in terms of in charting, which if you're the community rabbi, chaplain, you probably don't have clearance to chart, but you have the ability to go up to the nurse's station and advocate, which is really great. But I remember, like, the hospital did paper charting, and I don't do paper charting, I hope they don't do paper charting, but, like, handwriting in the psych chart, like, this long encounter with this young lady who was on the psych ward, locked unit, and was really forthcoming with me as chaplain, and, like, we had this whole pastoral encounter, really got really deep, and then her parents showed up for a visit, and her whole demeanor changed. She, like, shut down, and I had the ability to just, I didn't know the meaning of that, because I'm not treating her as a psychiatrist, so I just observed, like, stopped talking when parents showed up, you know, like, but just that observation may be useful information. The other is, of course, family meetings, like care conferences.
Yes.
I take chaplain.
Great. Yes.
I just think we talk about mental illness as if it's one thing, as if there aren't many mental illnesses. So here we have a bipolar patient, which is wildly different than a schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. Right? Someone with a schizophrenic diagnosis would. Right, so patients with these different diagnoses, the diagnosis matters in what we might do as a chaplain when we're walking in. So we on one hand do a service by saying we advocate for patients with mental illness. On the other hand, when we conceptualize all mental illness as a thing as opposed to different kinds of mental illness, that's not always helpful. And we don't really know what we're dealing with. How I might interact as a behavioral health chaplain with a patient with schizophrenia might look really different than a patient with major depressive disorder, really different than a patient with bipolar disorder who's in a manic phase, depending on whether I engage in a delusion or whether I'm supporting a spiritual piece. I think that's really important to get, as chaplains, more education on different mental components of mental illness as we start to encounter.
Yeah, I think that's true. There's a lot of times you're just not going to know, and these things can kind of mush together. And I think that if you're in, I still stand by what I said before, but I think if you inquire from a good place, entering into the delusion or asking about it, I don't think is necessarily supporting. I'm not saying you are the Mashiach. You know, you're saying about, like, that must be really feel very, that's a lot to think about, like, that you feel so responsible about Mashiach coming. That is a really weighty responsibility. And that's different than saying, I believe you, you know. I also, apropos of what you were saying, I think that the role of educator here is very powerful, because I remember I was just thinking, actually I didn't even think about it when I was writing this up, but I was thinking about when I was a resident, which was at Mount Sinai in New York, which had a lot, probably still was a lot of Hasidic patients, so it was in the summertime, and it was Tisha B'Av, and there was a guy who was there in full regalia, you know, Hasidic clothing, and he was saying, you know, I want this to be a holiday, I want it to be Purim, I want to eat, we're going to eat, we should dance, we should eat meat, we should eat fish. Now, what did that mean, what meaning did that have to the staff? Like, none, you know? But if I were, I don't know if I did or not, I can't even remember anymore, I just remember the story, to explain, like, what is Tisha B'Av? What is Purim? What is, you know, like, do they know that it's a fast day, and meat and fish has some kind of meaning of celebration? But I think that actually entering into that was, you know, which I do remember doing with that guy, was really kind of fascinating that he was turning this upside down.
Yeah, you were going to say.
I think that educational piece is really, really important. I know when I worked in an adult hospital, I actually was the behavioral health chaplain for that unit, But they had really never had such a person before. And one of the first things that I discovered is if the patient talked about religion during the assessment, the chart note would say, patient is religiously preoccupied.
Oh, well, that's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Patient is religiously preoccupied. So, and so it goes back to what I said.
Yeah, you did say that much earlier. Yeah.
Like, what is the relationship between spiritual care and...
Well, I think it's softened quite a bit since my, you know, I started. I mean, I think there's much more sort of respect and people, you know, ethics committees and all this kind of stuff. But it still, you know, it doesn't have like an easy history. Should we move on to a case of impaired judgment? Somebody who hasn't spoken and reading about Esther Landau. This is on page 3. A little bit of a less officially, speaking of diagnostic categories, no diagnostic category here, who would like to read? Big voice. Big loud voice. Somebody?
Esther Landau is a 61-year-old woman admitted to the hospital with severe pain in her back. She had a history of breast cancer and had a mastectomy at age 55. The surgery was uncomplicated, but because of spread of the cancer to regional lymph nodes, she was prescribed...
Arimidex. You know, one of the estrogen inhibiting type of things.
Okay, to reduce risk of recurrence. She did not comply with her follow-up regimen and flushed the pills down the toilet because she felt cured and didn't like poisoning her body with medication. Mrs. Landau admits that she doesn't like doctors and she hasn't had a checkup in 5 years. Diagnostic testing reveals that the pain in her back is vertebral metastatic breast cancer. Her physician recommends a course of radiation and chemotherapy as this significantly prolongs survival for patients in Mrs. Landau's condition, with many surviving beyond 5 years. Without any intervention, her long-term prognosis is grim. When the patient is informed of both her condition and the recommended therapy, she replies, "Nonsense. Last time I had cancer. This is just rheumatism, old age. I am 61 after all. My mother had back pain too, and I'm already older now than she was when she passed away." She also states to the evaluating psychiatrist, "Even if I did have cancer at my age, I wouldn't want anything heroic done. I believe in Hashem and know that he will take care of me." Mrs. Landau is a widow of 10 years with an adult son. The son insists his mother is not right in the head for refusing to accept her cancer diagnosis and treatment. He asked the doctors to intervene to impose care upon her. He also summoned the hospital rabbi, asking the rabbi to inform the patient that her choice is unreasonable.
So just your average chaplaincy patient. Yeah, right. But I mean, I assume that you've run across this kind of thing. I think we talked about this even before a little bit of the denial of pain control. It's a little bit, yeah, that's true. It's kind of related to that. So when you want to, we're not going to do the whole protocol, but like breaking it down in terms, okay, so you've been summoned. And let's just put it on the, like, Mrs. Landau is oriented to time, place, and person. She is not, you know, no one's going to 2PC her or declare her wildly incompetent. Do people have the right to make bad, sort of crazy decisions? Is sort of what this case is about, you know? Oh, it's a 2-position certificate, like to declare her insane and to, you know, whatever. Yeah, so.
I was wondering in this case, she's widowed. I wonder if this also just got a little care, kind of thing. Not just willful, whatever the psychiatrist said, willful denial, I just don't care.
Okay.
Although 61 isn't old, so I wonder if she
her mother died younger.
Yeah, right. But she's got this adult son, so she was an adult when she was widowed. She was middle aged adult. But I just wonder if there's something else going on under this besides the willful denial thing.
Okay, so your emotional pulse is saying, "Whoa, you know, yeah, all this stuff is going on, but you know, this feels like something else." And you would go for, tell me, you know, you would want to sit with her. And, okay, fine. Like, I mean, that we're always going with that one. Good.
Brief issues going on here.
Yes.
After,
okay.
Okay. I remember. Oh gosh, my first congregation. Remember, there was a woman and was widowed also around this age. And I remember her adult daughter said, "But mom's crazy. Mom just goes to the grocery store, just walks around the grocery store." Grieving and she's not able to get back into normal whatever. So I'd want to like interview and find out what else is going on with her that she's not going on. Did she ever get help for anything?
which goes back to who was it that said, I think maybe it was you, about how the chaplain can be an advocate for patients who really need, I mean, a lot of times, especially, this is not this case necessarily at all, but especially people who have a diagnosis of chronic mental illness get the worst care, get the worst psychiatric care, and get the worst medical care, because nobody sort of really wants to deal with it, because they're not attractive in a lot of ways, and they can be quite nasty and unpleasant, and so nobody, like, well, so what kind of a feeling permeates, you know, sort of surreptitiously. But I think that, absolutely, this is not an attractive situation. You know, people sort of don't really want to get close in on this. They're summoning in, you know, the outside troops to fix it, and you're really saying, hey, I'm going to investigate this. Maybe this is a situation of unresolved grief. Okay, other thoughts? Yes?
I would try to facilitate a conversation between the mother and the son.
Okay. Okay, and what are you going for?
I think it'll help me assess a little bit further what's going on, what that relationship looks like, and they, you know, maybe the son just can't hear that his mother is fine, and this is her decision anyways.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm just looking for the two of them to communicate and connect on some level, and, you know, maybe that'll help us.
And let's say the son were to say, Rabbi, are you crazy? Of course my mother could be, there's no reason for her to die now. Are you saying that this is that Hashem's going to take care of her?
What I'm saying is that you and your mom probably need to sit down and talk about this.
Well, I don't think we have that much time to sit down and talk, so we're sitting right now. Let's talk. So, Rabbi? You want to be mom? Yeah, your mom.
Sure.
Okay. Sure. Must someone take over for...
All right. What's the mom's name? Esther.
I don't know. Esther, yeah.
Okay. We're going to talk. Let's the three of us talk. Esther, help me understand what's going on.
What's the problem, Tatala? What's the problem? I know who I am. I know what I want. And Hashem's going to take care of me. And I don't think this is cancer. And I'm willing to take whatever comes.
I mean, she's crazy, obviously. Rabbi.
Talk to her.
Mom, you can't do this to me. You can't do this. This is crazy. You could live another 20 years.
I don't know. Maybe I will. But I don't need this treatment. I don't go for the treatment. I think I did fine last time. I'll be fine.
So you're just gonna let it happen?
Whatever's gonna happen is gonna happen.
Rabbi, tell her. Tell her this is not the Jewish way to go.
Sometimes it's really hard to validate people's free will, which is also a very Jewish value. And in this case, I mean, I'm conflating all this in my head.
It's great.
As we go. You know, part of...
I like the way, by the way, he said sometimes it's hard. It's like, he's not saying you're having a hard time. You're saying sometimes, which is another way of saying in my experience. That was very nice, yeah.
I think that when you listen to your mom tell you that, how are you feeling? What's going on with you?
I can't believe she's just going to leave me after all that we've been through. I can't believe she's just going to give up like that.
I'm not giving up, but I'm not going for this treatment. I don't see it as necessary or important.
But when Daddy was sick, you did everything. You were sleeping there nights. You were badgering the doctors. For him, you did everything.
He wanted everything, and I would hope you would sleep there nights for me, too.
Well, I'm going to sleep there nights watching you just let yourself die?
Who says I'm going to die?
Here we go again. Rabbi.
So let me ask you a question.
Okay.
I'm going to actually ask Esther. Esther, what do you think your son is telling you?
Well, I think he thinks I'm going to die and doesn't want to let me die.
Why?
I don't know why. Why?
Because I love you. Because I want you to be here.
I appreciate that. But if you love me, why don't you hear what I'm saying and listen to my wishes?
It's hard to hear, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really tough. And see. You're letting yourself out easy.
All right. Okay, let's go. Go ahead. Go ahead. Somebody else want to pick up? You could rotate.
I don't know, but there's a part of me. I mean, I love play acting. You know, there's this little girl in me that wants to play house again. But
You're on for the next one. That's all I can tell you.
I would have just stayed with you and wanted to know, like, where you're at. It could be that you really are done and you don't want to be around anymore. It could be that you're afraid. I would want to know what brought you to that place to say those things.
We didn't go further with it to dig deeper for that.
I'm hearing something else. Okay, so we hold on to that because there was a bunch of hands there. Go ahead, Michal.
Well, the piece I think would have been helpful to the rabbi because we actually know that she really does have metastatic breast cancer in her spine and that she probably will die. Mm-hmm. So as part of this conversation, it actually seems helpful to turn to the patient and say, no, you shouldn't. So it does look like this is what the doctors expect. Now, you do have this. You've had this before. You know, you didn't treat yourself, and that's why your spine is dissolving. So just know that your son is correct. I mean, you are probably going to die. I mean, just at least have that in the room and have your perception supported.
I don't know that I could not have gone there.
Uh-huh.
Why?
Well, go ahead.
Because
why?
I've heard too many doctors come in and say, and I work in hospice, so I've seen a lot of doctors come in and tell someone they've got 3 months. And you know what? It doesn't always work that way. And you know what? We're all going to die. So, I think that said, I would very much, I think, depending on if, you know, this goes into a more analytical or a more emotional kind of direction, would depend on who else do we bring into the conversation, who would be helpful to you, who would be helpful to you. I think we're just starting to talk to each other, and I would continue to work that aspect and try to get you to ask your mom why.
Okay.
I think you're essentially correct. We didn't go deeper. We ended the scene, as you proclaimed. But that was a good point to have the conversation that we're having right now. Had we gone first, I'm thinking about, so where might I have gone with this role play? I guess one of the things I might have explored with my son here is... all right, even if I do live 5 years, in what condition will I be? How much pain, how much suffering do I want to live like that? Hmm. And that's where I might have taken.
You know what's interesting? You say your thing. You're...
Well, I guess the only thing is, like, I mean, it would have been interesting if this role play was also with a physician in the room. I'll just throw that out there. Like, if it was a family meeting with a physician, to sort of add that piece so that it's not burdened onto someone who's not medical. But... something that would have been interesting as a means to go deeper is to use Esther's theological language to ask about the meaning of what it means that Hashem will take care of you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
To just say, like, what does it mean to you?
Yes.
Hashem, what does that look like? Because it might be, you know, that I'm going to have a peaceful, painless death. Or it could be... miracle, and then you have that whole other, like, you know, whole other, like, direction. But I think that would have been a nice entry point for the rabbi to go deeper, to ask what that means to you.
You know, a point that I just wanted to make here, I really appreciate what you said, is that it just made me think of something. I took painting this past summer, and I'm still actually painting. And there's always a question, like, when are you finished with the painting? Like, when do you kind of touch up? When do you add? And I was thinking about that when you were talking about this. Like, well, we ended the scene, but, like, there is sort of urgency, because I guess there is going to be a point of maybe she can get the, what are we going to give her that would help her? I forgot what it was. Oh, radiation and chemotherapy. But, like, if you decide that it's done, that your intervention is over, then it's over. But if you keep it open and you bring in these different levels that you've been talking about, it gets richer and richer. And one of the things I try to tell the students is, like, this goes back with being curious, like, allow yourself to get in deeper. So you didn't, so you have to leave, or you just felt like this was emotionally where you needed to end today. But then you have this idea, what does she mean by Hashem's going to take care of me? Or, you know, what about the husband? Or what about the whatever? And you just come back, and you deepen it, you know, you just kind of take out the green and the ochre and the whatever, and you start painting again or something.
There was a piece in here that from the beginning she did not comply with anything
true.
The doctor told
That's
her.
That's true. She's not a compliant patient.
She has no faith in medicine.
No?
He hasn't taken care of her up until
she
now.
She made her decision before we got to this point.
Right. So then you have, you're all the more like, well, why am I bothering? Yeah, go ahead.
So I think if we're talking in terms of sort of an ethics paradigm, the autonomy of the patient is going to be right over the beneficence of the medical system wanting.
Right, autonomy and beneficence, those magic
right,
words.
Those are the two values in conflict,
yes.
Right? But the autonomy needs informed consent. So this patient has to have an awareness of, yes, I know I have, I mean, to the best we can, yes, I'm aware this is my diagnosis, I'm aware this is what the doctors say is going to happen, and I'm making this choice anyway, right? I mean, in order, like, and how we get to that point, maybe bringing the doctor in, you know, or it's not necessarily like the chaplain's role to be the heavy in that.
But what is the chaplain's role here? I mean, that's a really good question.
Right, I mean, it might be, the chaplain's role might be to be the mediator and have the doctor say it directly to the patient, because maybe the doctor's always been talking to the son and not to the patient directly, or who knows, I don't know what's the scenario, but they're, you know, and it may be what the patient really understands that and mm-hmm. doesn't want the side effects and doesn't want this and that, and that's a different thing than just being in denial of the cancer.
Right. Paul, you had your hand up.
Steve first.
Oh, okay, Steve.
What I picked up on is mom hasn't changed.
Right.
There isn't a change in mom here. Mom has never been one to trust the medical system mm-hmm. or follow it scrupulously, and she is being who she has always been. The consequences of being her now may be up a stage mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. she's refusing this kind of thing, but her relationship to medicine and her set mm-hmm. of values aren't there. And my thought in my head is, you know, Hashem has gotten her here. He's taking care of me now. He got me past that other cancer, even though I flushed the pills.
Yep.
And Hashem is, you know, going to take care of me to the way it is. And my sense in here is that I need to some extent be supportive of mom, knowing that I've talked to her. She really believes this way and feels this way, and have to help her son become comfortable with a decision he doesn't like. But it's going to be mom's decision. So I have to pastor him with what's going to happen to mom in that kind of way, but not be the tool to beat up mom to get what the son wants.
Okay. All right.
That's how I see.
Okay. Yes, Paul.
I was going to say something of the same thing but from a different perspective. I don't think there is one thing here. I think there are two different cases here. You have to deal with each of them separately. That is to say, there's one kind of approach and conversation to be had with mom, and there's a second one entirely with the son, and they may end up in two different, so you may need to have two different sets of sessions with each of them, and then maybe bring them together to be appreciative of one another, and they may in fact be able to be appreciative of one mm-hmm. another, but I've been in one of these sessions where the flip was that mom and daughter decided it was time for mom to die, even though the doctor said she didn't need to.
Oh boy!
And ultimately they checked mom out of the hospital, and she went home to die. Mm-hmm. And it all had to do with dad dying the year before.
Yeah.
And
okay.
The inter-family nastiness among siblings to the point where if I were mom, I'd want out of that.
Okay, I mean, there's... Please, of course.
One more comment from Esther here.
This is Esther.
And kind of similar to what Paul was saying, but from a different perspective. This is where the Torah Shebichtav, in the form of the written narrative, sort of provides one path, and it seems like this is a question of Esther being suspicious of medicine and the medical profession. But in the Torah Shebaal Peh, which we didn't get to fully line out, we ended up at a really dramatic and good point, but I think where I might have gone with it if we had gone further, and this might have been another good path for the chaplain, is in exploring the relationship of the son and the mother.
Yeah.
What's underneath that, and where, you know.
Okay. Yeah. The other questions that we put in there, questions to consider, you can read at your own pace. I think that apropos of this kind of, we're talking about this this situation of denial of pain control, I don't know if this is something that you've come, you brought this up. How does that resolve? I mean, that's the opposite, but it's this related kind of situation. Like, how have you seen that be worked through?
It's really hard to get the loved one to come in to the place where their loved one, where their mother is.
Yeah.
And see what this looks like.
Oh, I see. I mean, they're saying no, kind of like from a distance.
Saying, they're saying, no, I don't want to do opiates because, you know, there's a great crisis going on.
Yeah, right.
I mean, this is a conversation we're having regularly now.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I don't want to give her, you know, morphine to help her breathe because I don't want to get addicted.
Sometimes
it's hard to say, but you have to say, you know, that's an issue when we're talking about a long term.
Yeah.
We don't have a long term here, and we want to help her.
And you found that to be pretty successful in people getting the support.
We had cases where there was no movement.
Yeah.
And then we have to make a decision.
Yeah.
And we go to our ethics committee.
Yeah. Right.
We have a patient who's in extreme amount of pain.
Yeah.
And we have a loved one who
wants
to administer medication.
Yes.
Well, we had this recently with a Jewish patient. Was actually.
Oh.
One of the daughters was the POA for healthcare. Was absolutely against pain medication, but complicated by the fact that while the mother had dementia, she was wanted pain medication.
Yeah.
And you have the POA, right? So the question, you have a very compromised decision maker, but still at least
this
decision, and she would be in excruciating pain whenever she was, you know, diaper changed, whatever.
Yeah, sure.
At bed bath, and the medical staff felt it was unethical to not give her.
Yeah.
Pain medication before doing these services, and patient would, if asked, would you like to have pain medicine so this doesn't hurt, would say, oh yes, like she was, so it was really
and the
daughter was nuts.
Yeah,
it was really like a whole of shame, I have to say.
And ultimately,
to the daughter, we are going to give pain medication, you can choose whether to continue with their hospice or not.
I see, yeah. Okay. All right, and now, Aggie, you're on.
I see this in my other world.
Yeah.
Because in my other world, I'm a licensed PT who does home care.
Yes.
The other place where I see this is post-acute surgery. We just had a knee replaced, a hip replaced, and they come home with narcotics because they desperately need them for pain control.
Yeah, yeah.
But the problem is the opioid crisis, because people go hyper over.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, so I feel like educating. If you're in pain and you're under medical supervision, then these are really wonderful things.
Yeah.
But there's always so much education.
Okay, Aggie, you're on. Aggie, this is your moment. We're on number four. You are the chaplain. We need a mom and a dad. Who's the mom and the dad? Mom and dad. Come on. It's our last. This is it. Aggie, you're over there. Go down there, because that's going to be your consulting room. We need a mom and a dad for Sally and Larry. Sally and Larry, you don't have to. You can play opposite genders. I don't care. Come on, people haven't talked too much. You have a wonderful chaplain who needs a couple. Please. Kids. We're on page four, the vignette, A Dying of a Child. We need a mom and a dad. Okay, you're the mom and dad. Go over there. You want to be your own genders? You want to be Sally and Larry? You want to feel like switching? Okay, let's switch. You be Larry, you be Sally. Okay, good. All right, so Chaplain Aggie, you want to read the story out loud? Because you're going to be, you read it. Okay. Degenerative.
He has had every treatment possible and was even flown abroad from an
experimental
treatment that failed. He is now very frail, unable to breathe on his own, and is likely to die in the next few weeks. His parents, grandparents, relatives, and friends of the family have rotated and in staying with
Okay, that's it. Now, so if you face your couple, and they're flipped. So it's going to be so we have Sally and Larry. So Larry, you have your line. You can just, you know, and just go with it. This is just an opening line. And we'll do this for like, I don't know, 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes, something like that. We can't hear you.
What would you like to talk to me about? How can I help?
I know I'm angry, but I really want to know. I'm hearing my wife say, what are we going to do? I don't know what to do with our kids. I'm having a hard enough time on this on my own. I don't know how to be a parent.
Thank you. So we'll spend like another 2 minutes and, you know, come and stop.
And I know you got to be soft. We're going to be a little louder so we can hear it this end of the room.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I think we'll stop here. Okay, so...
You were the comment...
Wait, let's see. Aggie needs a... What do you want to do? Before we say anything, Aggie, go ahead.
I am coming apart. You put me in a position that maybe you shouldn't have.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just went through this with a family that's very near and dear to me.
Oh.
And this was not good. Not the timing was just not good. I'm sorry.
Oh, you know, it's just amazing. So this has happened before that, you know, like art and teaching recapitulates
so
life.
Like, I can't speak.
Can you stay and can we speak about what you did? Because you were remarkable.
I was remarkable?
Well,
yeah.
I was trying to be in two places at the same time.
Oh.
Oh.
Well, please take, you take.
This was remarkable.
Wow.
No, because anybody... I don't have the other case, but anybody in the situation you're in,
oh,
this right now, this is a very, very tough. There aren't any answers, and you said that.
Yeah. Well, so do you want to just listen now for a bit? Or can
I need to take a breath.
Fine.
I was in two worlds.
Yes.
And then I'm in the third world because, like, you guys are expecting something from me.
Oh, my.
Well,
you know, I called you because you were so onto something before, and I thought, whoa, okay, Aggie's my person for the last role play. And, of course, I had no idea. Wow. But you know what you did do for us, and after all these years, I still get so moved by these role plays. I feel like it's really happening. I mean, you guys were amazing. The mom, you were like, whoa, the estrangement of a couple. But, you know, what you did model for us was when you are in a pained place because maybe you've had a case too similar. Something is amiss in your own family or your own coupledom or your own career, and you're raw and hurting, and then you're called to some kind of pastoral situation, and your heart is broken, and now it's going to be someone's trampling on the bits. So I'm sorry that this happened here, but I thank you for staying with it, because you did. You stayed with it. And that was really remarkable. And you were so calm. Your holding of this silence and this estrangement and pain was, well, Mom and Dad, Sally and Larry. How Larry? Sally, go ahead, speak. I know it's hard, but can you give it? Yeah, as Larry and Sally, yeah. You can speak as yourselves also. You can.
And to be a witness and to be
would be screaming.
In that moment, and just even like it would have been cathartic, but I would have been like going at it at with the way the frame was, and it was good. I would have like clawed into that. If that makes sense.
The family that I worked with, she couldn't yell, and so I did. And then she joined me, and we screamed. I closed the door, and we both just screamed until I could stop, and she could just carry on. And it was unbelievable. She lay on the floor and pounded and yelled, and she threw something also. And I said, "Look, you know, just go for it." And she just kept doing it until she had nothing left. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you know, that's when she was able to say, "Okay, I know that this is what it is."
Yeah. Go ahead.
I thought the invitation to scream was like brilliant.
Yeah.
I also think that we're like the calmest, quietest, most stoic, angry person I've ever seen.
But which I know as a mother of small children, like what my husband would call as my inner New York bitch would totally come out. Like my, like just, I'm like so angry just sitting here like, thinking about this case. Like just, my husband is like, you definitely have like, you know, you left New York, but you've got that in you. Like, just that inner New York, like, I would be that woman screaming on the floor. I would be that person in the trauma bay punching in the wall, I think, as, like, an angry parrot. Like, so, it was so fascinating. It almost, like, feeling like a disconnect. And I guess, like, maybe it's a cultural thing. Like, maybe it was because we were all in the room, but, like, the fact that you weren't yelling... Part of me was just like, as a mom, I was watching.
Well, there was enough. Let's have other. We're close to the end of time, so I want to give other people. Yes, please.
So it was. I really wanted Larry and Sally to touch each other.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
But
okay, good.
I think there might have been a dynamic where because Rob looks the way he looks, there might be a thought that that wasn't permitted, and you know.
Oh okay.
Have a chance to talk in advance about whether that would be permissible.
Larry already knows that I'm in despair, so I'm way past anger. I'm in the pit of, like, I'm here because I'm that desperate, I'll sit with the chaplain.
But wouldn't Larry reaching out their hand to you be helpful?
Larry gave up on that dream.
Yes, that's how I felt. Yes. I felt they were...
Went in the gulf of despair and...
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Giving up.
Yes.
I'm coming along, but that's
and also I thought it was very striking how our rabbi did not get busy with their estrangement, which I thought was a really important tactical move on your part.
But well, I think my experience is that everybody experiences pain differently, and so males, females, age differences. I don't know what their dynamics.
Now was not the time. By the way, you did a great gender thing. Problem solving, what do I do, what do I do, what I do? And that was terrific. I really, and I can't, my baby, you know, what do I, yeah.
And I do have thought your choice to not get whatever dynamics were here. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That was brilliant. Yeah. It would be so,
it was a, that was,
to get into those dynamics. And
right.
You were just really there.
Right. Sure. Other responses from the group here? Anybody? Ask, yes, please.
I just thought it was excellent, and sometimes I can't tell you how many times I've been intimidated.
Right.
Being in the same
by tragedy. By, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It just kind of just told me that I'm not alone in the struggle. That I think every person in this room here, as we enter into those sacred spaces, doesn't have all the answers, and maybe is not supposed to have all the answers.
And you know what? Maybe you get better, and you were really masterful. At saying, I like to keep track of this stuff. You know, I wish I had the answer. Maybe you get better at that, but I think that the tragedy of it doesn't get, you don't get more practiced at that, the terribleness of it, and I think we shouldn't. You know, if we get kind of callous, oh, another tragedy, that would really be a terrible thing.
I think that actually is one of the biggest challenges in it for the hospital.
Yeah.
Is that staff are not making a choice either they get fully enmeshed in a situation
or
they become ossified, so that they don't get enmeshed in situations and the survival. Coping is hard because this is one of, at least 10 situations that a staff person will see in a single day in a pediatric hospital. And it's not like it's not tragic when it's happening to adults, but I was saying to Brian at lunch, sometimes we do better with things that we can wrap our heads around and we can understand what happens when a 90 or 98-year-old person is at the end of life, but when a 9-year-old is at the end of life, we don't even have that to hang on to.
Right.
And
right.
I, I want to mention that, check in with them and to be with them, because it's one thing when we're with families and we, if there's a way to say the word help them through this, we journey with them. We don't, we don't, we're witnesses to their suffering. But the nurses see this day in and day out, and even though these are not their children, they are their children. If you talk with them, you find out they are their children. And so I just think it's a, it's an important for us to show up and be there for them.
Okay, well listen, I think we are at the end of the time, and thank you for the privilege of spending this day with you and for your openness and sharing and fellowship in this journey.
Get those tickets right there. There was, they look like funny money. They look like monopoly money. Thanks very much, everybody. What's that? You got to fill the evaluations out. Tournament either. Tournament to Milano.
Well, that's a good question. You know, I mean, it's actually more like when I looked at that literature, the Christmas pastoral house is quite Christmas. I care a lot about.